I want to start this with maybe a passage of scripture you don't normally associate with Mother's Day. Hopefully you'll see that it does apply before we're done. But if you would, turn with me to Exodus chapter 2. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and she saw that he was a fine child. Or when she saw that, she hid him for 3 months. And when she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. She took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse this child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because she said, "I drew him out of the water." Now go to the other end of the Bible, to Hebrews chapter 11. Like Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. Verse 23. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. So it's Mother's Day. Everybody who's a mom got treated special already today, hopefully. Yes, a few. Well, there's big news for moms. And we're going to have a slide here for something that you all recognize as the big news of the week, which was what? The arrival of Prince Archie Harrison Mountbatten / Windsor. Did I get that right? So this, of course, was a big deal. It's in the press. Baby announced with the Queen Mother standing by, doing pretty well at 93 years old. An American star who now is the Duchess of Sussex, holding Prince Archie, who's seventh in the line for the throne, giving him just a slightly better chance of becoming king as anyone of the boys in the room over here. And there are a bunch of them, by the way. So this was the big news of the week. And, of course, this kind of celebrity status is somehow fascinating to people in the world. It's not exactly the same kind of experience like my wife would report on having a child. Our families and our mom experiences are more like the next slide, which are still posed, but they're pictures of here's Darlene with her mom, who was here just a few weeks ago, 91 years old. Great-grandchildren down below, my mom, who's passed away several years ago, but with our kids. By the way, it's no easy feat to get four kids to line up and take a picture, so this is actually a pretty valuable photo to us. And then you go to the next slide, and that is, what is it about real life? It's actually this slide. And that is, most moms don't feel like a celebrity. They, of course, experience life with real issues. And the truth is, every mom, every parent at some point feels some sense of desperation and trying to deal with children, and it gets a little bit above the way they think they can function, right? They want help. And part of what I want to address today is the fact that I think there's something to learn from a biblical story, often thought of as a child's story, that deals with a mom somehow out of desperation who has something to tell us today. So we're going to talk about lessons from a desperate mom. I can tell you that thinking about moms and real issues, I grew up in a family with five kids, so it was a circus. My mom was a terrific mother, and yet she did that in spite of being married to a pretty difficult husband and having this circus of children around her all the time, fighting her own battles with depression, and in the end left an indelible impression on everybody who knew her as somebody who cared, exercised wisdom, and I just don't think there's anybody who leaves an impression on a person more than their mother. So it's an amazing influence that has had, and no pressure, moms, but that's, we're all dependent on you. So the story we come to today, and we'll go to the last slide, there actually was a Russian painter in the 1800s who pictured this story of the baby who somehow at 3 months looks like he's 2 years old and about to jump out of that basket. But anyway, here's the whole entourage of royal family and attendants at the shore of the Nile River rescuing this baby, and of course, great Bible story, right? So that's all we need from that. And we'll get back to the story now. But to really appreciate it, I think we need to understand the whole picture of what's going on in the Bible leading up to this point. And then, of course, we have this great privilege of having the Hebrews commentary on it at the end. But if you start with the book of Genesis, turns out the Bible says a lot of things about mothers. Starting in chapter 3, after Eve left the Garden of Eden, ate the fruit, they had to leave the garden. And God told Eve a couple of things. He promised her a couple of things. First, you're going to have babies. And second, it's going to hurt a lot. So our experience with this goes back to the absolute climax of the age of natural childbirth, 1979, Lincoln, Nebraska. Our first child is due. We go to the hospital, and we're all prepared because we've been taking what? Lamaze classes, right? So we're totally coached, we're ready, and in those days, the most severe cultural sin possible would be for a mother to use any kind of medication when she had a baby. Seems implausible now, I'm sure, to you, but at that time, that was the thing. So 16 hours into labor with nothing to help the bone-crushing contractions, this is true, Darlene reached up, grabbed me by the neck, I remember like it was yesterday, pulled my face down to hers, and said, "This hurts. I want something for it now." And of course, I was well coached, so I patted her on the shoulder and said, "You know what we agreed on, just breathe." Easy for me to say, right? So a few hours later, our first child was born. Darlene seemed to get over it enough to have a second child. Personally, I was horrified. I don't know why anybody goes through that. But by the third child, with basically doctors getting more compassionate and intelligent, Darlene discovered the greatest gift to motherhood in history, which is the epidural block, right? Where you feel no pain from the waist down. So four children, two by the hero method, she calls it, and two by the more civilized method involving an epidural. So the bottom line is that children impact their mothers from the beginning. And while it's amazing to me someone would go through that and then do it again, it happens, and we're all grateful for the moms that are here. This kind of story has a setting, like I said, that starts in Genesis, and we have a whole series of events that come up to the time, and this is the context, if you're actually taking notes on this, this is the context that feeds up to the time when Moses' mother, by the way, we know her name, it actually comes up in a genealogy in Exodus chapter 6, Jochebed, how's that? That sound Hebrew enough? Okay, got the thumbs up. So Jochebed is facing this crisis because, as we just read, she's in fear for her son's life. So we know from the stories in Genesis, from the whole history of the Hebrews coming along, that Abraham came to the promised land. He didn't get to own it. He was a nomad. Isaac and Jacob came along, and eventually there's Joseph. Most of you know these stories. There's a famine in the land. Joseph, through a bunch of cruelty of his own brothers, ends up in Egypt. But the next thing you know, I'm sure it took a while, but he becomes the prime minister, and he saves his family from starvation by bringing them to Egypt. And then at the end of Genesis chapter 50, verse 24, he promises the people that God will bring them back to the land that was promised to Abraham. So actually, there are two things that he promised Abraham. Your descendants will inhabit this land, and in chapter 12, verse 3, all people of the world will be blessed through you. So we get all these kind of signs of what's coming through history, even in the book of Genesis. So I think Moses' mom knew these things, and time passes. In fact, a lot of time passes. Over 300 years passes with the Hebrews having babies, living life, growing as this group of people inside the land of Egypt, to the point where another Pharaoh comes along. This is in Exodus chapter 1. He looks around, he says, "All I see is Hebrews. I'm a little worried about this." And so he passes an edict that says, first of all, we're going to make them slaves. We're not going to waste all this labor. And second, I'm tired of these people outbreeding us. Let's kill all the baby boys. So he actually tells the people in his, all the Egyptian citizens, you know, if you see a Hebrew baby boy, throw him in the Nile, feed him to the crocodiles, but you can let the girls live because we can make them work. So that's what's going on right now when the baby is born in the house of Amram and Jochebed. So here's the baby. For 3 months, she manages to keep him quiet enough that she's not worried about the neighbors, but she's thinking of a plan during this time. She has lots of time to scheme for this. And eventually, the lungs are developed enough where she knows she can't keep him hidden much longer. And that's where we are in Exodus chapter 2. She has to face this dilemma that I got to come up with something that helps save this child. And by the way, in the back of her mind, probably all the oral traditions been passed along, she knows the history of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. She knows there's a promise that they're going to go back, but it's been 350 years. If you think about it, put that in perspective. I mean, what was going on here 350 years ago? There was no United States. There was no state of Colorado. There were maybe a few Native Americans along the bank of the Platte River eating trout, but there was nothing of what we see now. So that's a long time for God to basically form a nation inside of a nation that's now ready to go back and take its land and become what he had planned for in history. So that's the perspective, that's the context, but all those promises seem a little distant and far away to a mother with a crying baby who she's afraid is going to be discovered any day. So here we are in Exodus chapter 2, there's a threat to her child, and she comes up with this plan. And it involves taking a basket and coating it with whatever gooey stuff they had at the time that would make it float, covering it so that a baby could go in it and go in the reeds away from the crocodiles and be protected and not subject to the African heat. And now the interesting thing to this, to me, is that the actual word used here for basket is the same word used for ark in Genesis 6. In other words, I'm pretty sure what she did is she knew how God saved Noah and his family, and she made a one-person version of an ark and went to the river, placed it in a place where, as it turns out, Pharaoh's daughter, the princess, bathed, and then posted Miriam, whose name we know later as well, the older sister of Moses, around the corner to kind of watch what was happening. Now, how much of this was accident? How much did she plan for? I don't know exactly. We don't have all the details, but there was some planning involved with this thing that involved protecting her child. She could have given up. She could have gotten angry at God and said, "This is hopeless." She could have grabbed the baby and ran, which probably didn't have a high percentage of success, but instead she came up with these ideas. So there are a series of lessons here, I think, for each of us, and this first one goes something like this. I need a plan. In other words, I need wisdom for facing an issue of desperation. Talked a little bit about this a few months ago when I was up here. Wisdom being basically the skill in living that starts with a heart that God prepares to make compassionate and thoughtful responses to the things that are going on around me. And I need to operate this way if I'm going to face difficult circumstances. So I need a thoughtful plan. I need wisdom. And I need to be in a way like Moses' mother was, willing to think outside the box. So all of us, at least I'm wired this way, as the airport engineer, I love to have things follow the rules. I want a set of specifications to do everything. I would like to have a formula for my children to turn out perfect. I would love to have the three easy steps to success and financial security. And if you're honest, most of you, at least the guys, are wired that way too, right? That's the way we want life to be. So there's a line here between wisdom and doing the best we can and understanding that God is still in charge of the universe. And that's lesson number two, which is what the Hebrews commentary does for us, that we need to have a good God. Well, that sounds silly because we know we have a good God, but what I'm talking about is the fact that we need to have faith. We need to understand who God is and how He works with us. That's what the Hebrews passage does to complete this picture. One of the most amazing statements in this passage in Hebrews is that the parents, and by the way, it does list both the parents as having faith, had no fear of Pharaoh, most powerful guy in the land. I mean, this is like being in the middle of Afghanistan surrounded by the Taliban and saying, well, I'm not afraid of this. That's the kind of image that we have here. Moses' parents were not afraid of what Pharaoh had said. And why is that? Because they believed that God was more powerful than Pharaoh. That seems baseline, but they were thinking this way when the mom, by the way, it doesn't say the dad did any of this. Did you figure that out? Dad had faith, but actually mom did all the planning and the work to try to take care of the baby. But anyway, she understood that God was more powerful than Pharaoh, and she understood that God was interested in her child. I think there's a lot in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, that kind of leads up to this understanding of faith. So I need to have faith, and I would welcome that you would turn to Hebrews 11 and just glance down with me some of the things that bracket what this is all about. Starting with verse 1, we get some description of how faith works. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen. So we believe that God's at work, even though all the blanks aren't filled in for us, but we understand His nature and what He's doing on our behalf. It says in verse 6, without faith, it's impossible to please Him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that He exists and He rewards those who seek Him. So He's there. He is the Creator, the most powerful being in the universe, but He has individual concern and care for us as people. And then if you go down to verse 34, talks about all the people in this chapter, and it says they were made strong out of weakness. So God is, through faith, empowers us to do things, to handle situations beyond us that we don't have the strength to do. He actually provides the energy, the power for that. And this whole chapter, if you follow through it, and anyone know what this is normally referred to, chapter 11 of Hebrews? Honor roll of faith, you've heard of this before? Got all these names listed. Several of them are men in the Bible who are famous. We know their stories. Abraham, Noah before him, Moses himself is in this story. But there are also three moms in this list of people of faith. Sarah, Abraham's wife, Rahab, the prostitute, it says, who was in the line of Jesus and was the person credited for rescuing or hiding the spies who came into the land. And then, of course, Moses' mother herself is listed here. So you've got this whole statement of how faith is exhibited by people, and that gives us the perspective on what's going on in her mind and the message to us that we're not afraid She wasn't afraid of the powers around her that were a threat to her child, and she wasn't afraid that God wasn't watching. She was confident that he had something to do with this and that he would act on her behalf. She also had in mind what she knew God had in store for the Hebrews, at this time. That one, they were going back to the land somehow. Two, they were going to be the nation through which redemption came to the rest of the world. And there probably was going to be a deliverer. I wonder if she thought in her mind, she wondered in her mind if there might be something in the future for Moses to get them out of this terrible situation of slavery that they were in. And that leads to the third lesson, and that is, I need to know God's plan for redemption. So, this is the interesting thing about all these personal stories in the Old Testament. They all paint a picture that actually leads up to Jesus himself. This whole plan of redemption was not only in her mind, but actually, it affects us today, of course. So, in the book of Hebrews, towards the end of the chapter of chapter 11, it says that, I'm going to turn to that now, 11:39, I believe. All these people in Hebrews 11, all these heroes of the Old Testament, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised. Why is that? Because they were looking forward, trying to figure out what would happen, and yet they had faith. We today have faith knowing what did happen, and that God brought salvation to the world, and we're all part of that message to the world around us. So that's a perspective that we have. Not only do we need to exercise life under stress, pressure, anxiety, and all the things that affect us with a plan, with wisdom, understanding God's working for our good, our faith, but we're all part of the plan of redemption that God brought to the world. So this is leading to what I'll call a simple point of application. And it's almost trite to say it, but it goes something like this. All children are God's children. Well, okay, duh, right? All children are God's children. I believe Moses' mother understood this through her faith in a way that should inspire us as well. And this applies to moms who will face that crisis of, what do I do with my kid? This applies to dads who are trying to parent kids, and it applies to anyone who, maybe you're not a mom or a dad, but you need to realize this. So if I go back again to personal stories, I'm reminded that kids will make destructive choices. I mean, not only when they're young, but as they grow. I recall vividly our house in Aurora back when Frank, our third child, was young. I had a habit of really getting consumed with what I would do at work. So I would come home and I'd still be preoccupied with that. And one night, Darlene called me on it and said, you know, we really need you here mentally when you come home from work. So somebody had given me some advice, and I developed this habit of standing on the porch right before I'd come through the door and just symbolically taking all the things that were still spinning in my mind about work and setting it on the porch and then walking through the door. So I'm doing this routine once. Again, like I said, there are two older sisters and then Frank, who was a toddler at the time, and the door opens, and Darlene handed me Frank and said, here is your son. Now, I was thinking of the argument because I was in the room when he was delivered. I was pretty sure he was our son. But the better part of wisdom at that moment was just to take him and he would be my son that night. So later on, I would find out the details that involved torturing house pets, biting sisters, breaking things and generally terrorizing the house in any way he could reach stuff. But at the moment in time, I was taking him. He was my son. And I believe everybody should be prepared for the point at least every mom should be prepared for the point, when you're saying to God, this is your child. In our own experience, I mean, it starts with what was actually a manageable situation, and it got into craziness with at least three of our children in teenage years who went on ahead and carried some of the effects of bad choices into adulthood, and they've had to suffer the consequences of those. And we, as parents, never stop wanting to fix them. We never stop asking God to help. And actually, we reach the point where kind of the first thing we say is, God, this is your child. We're trying to do our part. But let's face it, if you just think about it, how could I possibly be as good a parent as God is? I mean, he's not subject to the same frustrations that I have. He cares, I love my kids, but he cares more deeply for every individual on the planet more than I ever could. And basically, he has more resources available to help than I do, right? He's pretty good at his job of running the universe. He can actually manage the circumstances that can improve things. So, a couple of suggestions. Moms, maybe there are all kinds of resources out there and you should use them, but maybe you start with the fact you can relate to God and say, I don't know where this is going, but this is your child. And I'm going to trust you to do some things that I may not be able to do here. Simpler when they're young. It gets really complicated when they get older. Dads, you can learn from your wives. I mean, I start with the analytical approach to every problem. Darlene tends to start with, is there somebody hurting here that I can relate to? So I've actually learned something about this, and it turned out that it was not all that helpful to immediately start with defining the problem, establishing a list of options, and going to the best one analytically in front of an emotionally traumatic situation. Maybe it starts with, I care about you and want to try to figure out how God can help in this. In fact, God is in charge of this whole situation. So if you're a child, you don't relate to moms and dads, and maybe you come from a family that isn't perfect. Families tend to be messy. At least mine is. Yours are perfect, right? At least our family is messy. I can remember a time we moved into a new house in a nice neighborhood in the suburbs of Dallas, and it was about the time our two older girls were entering adolescence. Bizarre makeup and clothing was showing up. At one point, the oldest daughter was wearing all black. Second daughter shaved her head, and Frank was generally out terrorizing the neighborhood in any way he could think of. And our neighbors nicknamed us, as they talked to the other neighbors, the Adams family. I don't think it was a compliment. And our kids still talk about this. And so maybe you feel like you came from that kind of a family. Well, here's the good news in that as well. Guess what? You don't have to have perfect parents. You actually do have a perfect parent. Again, in God's big plan, you can talk to God yourself, because he's not just the father of mankind. He's actually your mom and dad. So at the end of the day, I think there are lessons for us here from this kind of obscure story about a mom putting her baby in a little ark and dropping it at the edge of a river. We're going to face all kinds of things that challenge us. We're going to act out of desperation, and we can do it either in a crazy way, an irrational way, we can do it in a very formulaic way, or we can start with where I believe this lady started, which is, this is yours, God. I don't know where you're going with all this, but you've got everything from my child to the history of mankind in your hands, and I trust you. So there's a young woman in the audience here. I won't ask you to come up, Anna. who faced all kinds of dark moments, depression, made some choices that really had effects on her, even tried to take her life. Some of you know her story. What you may not know is that the hundreds of things we did together to try to help, and eventually there was only one thing left, and that was for Mom and Dad to say, God, this is in your hands. Can you do something about this? Well, all I can say is she's here today in this church, and the church is a place where things like this can take fruit, right? Matt?
Yes.
I'm going to give it back to you.